I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. Bob started the Review with co-editor Barbara Epstein in 1963 during a newspaper strike, and the Review continues to be one of the leading journals of books and ideas. Welcome.
Well, very good to be here.
How would you, the editor and creator of the New York Review of Books, describe the publication?
Well, it's a. I have to say that we started this paper, both of us, Barbara and myself, as people who came out of literary journals. I worked for Paris Review for years, and then I edited a special edition, literary edition of Harper's. And Barbara worked for years as an editor at Doubleday and of many famous, well-known books, and also on Partisan and Review. And we were both involved in quite other things until we were given a fantastic opportunity, which I think is probably historically unique.
And how did you go about deciding to start this Review of Books?
In 1963, the New York Times came into a kind of Luddite strike where the linotypists were striking against the new installation of digital processes. It was a doomed effort, but it knocked the Times out for 3 months. At which point, there was a dinner at the house of Jason and Barbara Epstein, for great friends of mine, and Elizabeth and Robert Lowell. And Jason made the remark that wasn't life more easier without having to read the New York Times? And so, but they suddenly thought, well, why not start a literary paper? And the next morning, Jason rang me at Harper's and said, we've been had this dinner. We thought it'd be a great time to start a literary paper. And because the publishers in New York are going crazy, they're going crazy because the books are coming out inexorably from the presses. They're going to the bookshops. There's no way to stop it, but there are no reviews. So every publisher, if you have a plausible literary paper overnight, will have to take a page of advertising. And therefore, this is the first time in history that we could start a literary journal with no capital, none. So he said to me, would you be willing to take a leave from Harper's and plunge into this effort? And I went to see the editor of Harper's, Jack Fisher. Couldn't have been a nicer editor. He said, yes, go ahead. Try it. It'll be a good experience for you, and you'll be back in a month. And so Barbara and I we drew up a maquette, and we met in the Harper's offices late at night and with Lizzie, and we picked out books, and then we sent them the books of the season. We sent them to the writers in the world we admire the most.
And people, who were those writers?
Well, those writers were people who often had not written reviews or for years. Norman Mailer, William Styron, W.H. Auden, Mary McCarthy, Edmund Wilson, Alfred Kazin, Gore Vidal, Irving Howe, those were just a few of the writers, not to mention Robert Lowell himself, Elizabeth Hardwick herself, and poets like John Berryman.
Did you pay these writers?
We sent the books out and we said, you have 3 weeks to do a review. We can't pay a penny. We're doing it to start a new book review. Every single one came through.
Mm.
They came through because they felt the need.
Now, had any of them written book reviews prior?
Yes, some of them had. Oh, everyone had written a book review here, a book review there, often in Partisan Review or in the Kenyon Review. Some had contributed to the New York Times. But most of them simply were not reviewing in any regular way for the New York Times or any other paper. Norman Mailer hadn't written a book review in years, and he wrote a marvelous review for us.
What was that review?
It was a review of a reminiscence, a memoir by Morley Callahan, a Canadian writer, about his days in Paris, where he knew Sinclair Lewis and Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And he, as Norman, brilliantly, he was a brilliant literary critic, Norman, when he wanted to be. He said, this is a rather perfunctory, rather dull book. But it has one thing in it that is of the greatest interest. There was a fight between Callahan, a boxing match between Callahan and Hemingway. Fitzgerald was the timekeeper, and he let the round go beyond the time of 3 minutes during which Callahan knocked out Hemingway. And Hemingway never forgave Fitzgerald. So Mailer then went on about what that meant, for someone like Hemingway. It meant a deep resentment of Fitzgerald, and also some kind of challenge to his own sense of himself. And he then speculated about Hemingway and how fragile a character he was, and how, as he wrote in this piece, I suspect, he said, he thought about suicide every day, because he was a man who was so much on the edge, he had to project this huge, confident, masculine, hairy front. That was Mailer's view.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Silvers, co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. He ran the review for 43 years with co-editor Barbara Epstein, who died in 2006 of lung cancer. So you had this impressive list of names of writers who were going to contribute Yes. to the review. And so how did you go about convincing publishers to advertise?
Well, we just went to the publishers' offices, because we knew many of these publishers. There was no question of who to go to. We would simply call them up and say, we have something to show you. What Jason said was true. One publisher after another, Random House, of course, where he worked, and that was a help to us, but also Holt, Doubleday, Harper's, they all took a page.
Now, incidentally, you mentioned Barbara and Jason Epstein, who
yes,
were married at the time.
They were.
And Jason was a pioneer, not just in thinking of creating this New York Review of Books, but he was also a pioneer in another way. He had come up with the idea of creating paperbacks for classics as well.
Yeah. Well, I would say what we would call quality paperback. And what he created was the quality paperback that appealed particularly to university and highly sophisticated audiences. They had existed in Europe, but this was something new in the U.S. And it's just one of his many ideas, and he's a man of extreme brilliance.
So speaking of ideas, another one of his and your ideas was this review of books.
That's it. Jason had the notion that this was the time, and his instinct was turned out to be true, because the strike continued. We put out the issue. Then Jason had another idea, which was, make bundles of these issues and send them out to the leading university bookshops. We sent them with a little note saying, we have a new paper. If you sell it, you're on your honor to send us back the proceeds. Of course, they all sold out, got a lot of attention. We got the Polk Award that year for taking some kind of initiative. And then we put out a second special issue. And by that time, we had decided to go for it.
So you decide after these two successful
That's right.
initial issues
yeah.
to proceed on a regular
yeah.
basis.
And try and raise money. And try and raise money. We didn't need that much, actually. And funnily enough, one of the biggest contributors was Brooke Astor. We'd heard from a friend of hers, Blair Clark, who was a friend of Robert Lowell, that she was interested in the paper. She'd been reading it. And he called us up and said, you better go see her. We went round, and she had the paper. She'd been reading it. She said she'd been a book reviewer herself in her day when she worked on magazines. How much time did we give these reviewers? She asked us. And she put in, a large sum of money, became one of the principal stockholders.
Do you remember what that sum of money was in 63?
Well, it was over $50,000.
And do you remember going to her apartment?
Very well. We had spent the afternoon there talking about book reviewing.
What was most memorable about that experience?
Well, I was most memorable was her vitality and her absolutely serious and genuine interest in article after article. She was someone who had written book reviews herself as a young woman for the early Vanity Fair. And she had been an editor for years, on House and Garden. She was very much a journalist, Brooke.
Was this manna from heaven? Things are going well. People are reading the review. You're getting funding.
We all had friends who put in a little money. But here again, and I want to point out more about the genius of Jason Epstein, he conceived something which was crucial. He divided the shares that we had into two groups. The B group was the group of contributors. Of the people who bought the shares, like Brooke Astor. And the A group was us, just the Lowells, the Epsteins, and myself and Whitney. That's it. and we had A shares. And according to the bylaws of this corporation, the people who owned the A shares had all the power, power to appoint the editor, for example.
So there was this independence that was maintained.
More than independence, it was freedom. In other words, this is a, I would say, if there's any single factor that we have benefited from, it's been freedom. In other words, there was no proprietor, no boss, no foundation, no government, no group of any sort that could tell us what to do. We had no, if we were making mistakes, it was us. If we were going to take a difficult position, it was us. So therefore, when a history presented us with difficult choices, for example, the Vietnam War, we had no one to say to us, now look, we must not criticize this war too much because we don't want to seem too, let us say, failing in our support of the troops or something like that. So we had freedom not only politically, if we encountered conundrums and challenges from history, but we also had freedom to experiment. We had no one said, oh, you're a book review, you can't do this or you can't do that. Anything that we felt we wanted to do that would be marvelous for the paper, such as publishing an article on the movies or sending some writer we respected on a voyage to report on some far-off place, we could.
You talk about freedom and independence, and that's been very important to you. And your publisher, Ray Hederman, seems to have given you free rein.
Well, I think it's been, for the last 25 years or so, been a crucial element in our lives. Along came Ray Hederman, who had been editor and owner of most of the papers in Jackson, Mississippi, and wanted to establish himself in New York, who knew the New York Review, who admired it. He came and made it and said he would like to be publisher and take over the ownership. And we were in a quandary because we thought it would be very nice to have a terrific publisher who would improve the paper's business. But how would it affect us? And, of course, we were extremely suspicious. But after several months of conversations, we suddenly realized that Ray Hederman was absolutely sincere in extending this absolute guarantee to us of freedom, editorial freedom. He said, why should I want to change it? He liked it. And he kept his promise.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. We'll hear more from Bob coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. Bob started the review with co-editor Barbara Epstein in 1963 during a newspaper strike, and the review continues to be one of the leading journals of books and ideas. The New York Review of Books is not just a critique of books, but it is also a place for political commentary and commentary about world events. What's an example of that?
V.S. Naipaul. He joined us very early as one of our reviewers. He wrote articles for us, and he expressed interest in what was happening in Argentina, where the generals and colonels had taken over, and there was a lot of torture. And this was a great human rights problem of the time. And a friend of mine put up some money and bought him a ticket. He stayed there for weeks, and he wrote the most brilliant reportage, not only on the horrors of the colonels, but also on some of the ugly tendencies of the Peronistas. And he showed the populist impulse and the often rather suppressive elements, both of the military and of the Peronista elements in Argentina. And it was a great, really went beyond that to describe a culture of violence, a culture of quandary and disappointment in Argentina. Now, that's what a writer like that could bring to a political, historical situation. Same thing with sending Joan Didion to El Salvador during the war there.
When the New York Review of Books had its debut in 1963, What was the New York Times' reaction to your debut?
Well, I don't remember any particular reaction. The New York Times was a very august and very self-confident and very important paper. And it, by the way, it's not really a competitor to the New York Review. They have a completely different task. They're supposed to review, they have a mission to review comprehensively the most important books, or most books that come out. From the very first, we said we will not review most of the books. We will review the books of the season that interest us, and we'll put aside a large numbers of popular books, which may not interest us, except, as we said in our original statement, from time to time, to call attention to a fraud.
Huh. What does that mean?
It meant that some books are really very deeply vulnerable and need, and one has to criticize them.
You just can't resist.
Well, it's a public service.
I see. Do you ever feel the desire to write your own pieces? Because from the inception, you were the editor. You were
That's not right.
A writer. Has that created some frustration for you?
No. And I feel that's been lucky. Because, you know, there are various kinds of people who edit, and some of them are indeed frustrated writers and are always working on their novel or something while they edit. I've always thought of the editor as a middleman. He's a middleman and essentially an admirer, a fan. On the one hand, he admires great writing. He admires the people of brilliant minds. On the other hand, he wants to bring their work to readers. He's between the two. I think it's a mistake for that person, the middleman, to start competing with these great writers. On the contrary, what you want to do is find ways to present their work to a wider public.
Have you always been in the position of an editor? And I'm talking about even in your childhood.
No.
Where instead of being the star, the writer, you were that person behind the scenes.
No, for years I worked as a journalist. I worked for the United Press in Washington. I worked for magazines. I wrote articles for papers while I lived in Paris to keep the ends of life together. but what I dreamed of was working with great writers, the most talented in the world.
I want to go back to your earlier life. You grew up on Long Island.
I did.
And your father was a Wall Street guy who became a poultry farmer.
He was a businessman. He'd been a farm boy in Connecticut as a boy. In the late 20s, he had enough money to buy a farm, which he thought we were going to, they would have had a flat in the city. He thought we were going to use this farm as a kind of nice country place. Then the Depression came, and he retired to the farm. We had 5,000 chickens, we had goats, we had some crops. In those days, there was a big woods, and it was like, for children, a paradise. My mother, who had been a music critic and the old New York Globe, and settled for this life in the country, but she took us every Saturday to New York to hear the Ernst Schelling children's concerts and go to a museum in the city. She wanted us always to have a touch of city life. And my brother and I were always congratulating ourselves on having had such a good time.
You went to the University of Chicago and graduated at 17
yes.
years old.
It was 1945. It was just after the war. There were thousands of veterans coming into the campus. The whole world seemed open politically, culturally. My roommate at one point was a 30-year-old bomber pilot. And there was enormous freedom on this campus, and yet there was a commitment on the part of the university that every student in the college would essentially read the same curriculum, from Aristotle to Bertrand Russell. Everyone read Freud, everyone read Marx, everyone read St. Augustine, everyone read Plato, everyone read Dostoevsky, everyone read Flaubert.
Was your experience at the University of Chicago germane or formative or
seminal? I believe I owe it practically everything because, as you'll see from the New York Review, in every issue there is an article on science, there is an article on art, there is an article on literature, there is an article on social questions. And so the range of and demands of that particular form of education left its mark on all of us.
At what point did you decide you wanted to be in the literary world and become a writer or an editor? When did that happen?
Well, it was odd. I went on to Columbia. I studied philosophy there. And then I was, a friend of mine was in Washington and said there was a job at the United Press they could help me get. And I did work there overnight. Then I got a job as press secretary to Chester Bowles, governor of Connecticut, at a very young age. And then I was drafted. And because I'd been press secretary to governor, I think it was during the Korean War, they sent me to Paris and to the NATO headquarters. And in those years, I met the editors of the Paris Review. And I met George Plimpton at that time. And during
the founder of the Review.
He was running the Paris Review. He was there in a little office. And he said to me, you know, if you're here in the Army, when you get out, why don't you join us? So I did.
It's interesting. It seems like you became a writer. It almost happened to you rather than you're having a sense of agency about it. When you became press secretary, it wasn't that you were looking to become a press secretary.
No, you're right. They
asked
me.
Or with the Paris Review, people asked you to join. So
that's
there didn't
right.
seem to be much of an entrepreneurial engine somehow.
No, it was a question of miraculous opportunities opening up. You're so right when you say that. I feel again and again the luck of life that when you bump into somebody and you get to know them and they say, hey, why don't you join us?
And similarly, with the New York Review of
yeah.
Books, you were asked.
That's right. And the same when Jack Fisher came to Paris one day and he said, look, I've seen your work on the Paris Review and we'd love you to come into New York to be an editor on Harper's. And he said, we'll pay your way back. We'll give you some money for a flat. And I thought, well, who else is asking me to back this way? And why not give it a try?
It seems that despite your being asked and not having a sense of agency about these things, you really have taken on leadership roles once you have embraced whatever
Well,
role
I think
it is.
You putting it away, I hadn't really thought about it, but you're right. These were marvelous lucky chances that have come to me in life and marvelous lucky jobs, really.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Silvers, co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. The Review has a circulation of roughly 143,000 and has managed to be profitable since 1966, 3 years after it was started. You now have a circulation of 143,000. How has it come to that? How do you think you've mustered or acquired those readers?
We can't believe it. We never had any idea we would be so big. Barb and I always felt that that there was a whole range of publishing, editing questions that we wouldn't go into. We never took surveys. We never had focus groups. We never did anything in the marketing. Our idea was that if you have brilliant articles that seem marvelous to us, seem interesting and exciting, that people will read them.
Still, even if your content is appealing to a diverse
yeah.
group of people, it's still another to actually get those people to sign up for the magazine.
It is, of course, and it is a difficult thing. But that is, I think, another key to the paper, which is this, renewal. The key to the business, as I understand it, and I'm not a great expert on it, but it is basically how people renew. So our renewal rate is well over 80%. That's one of the, considered in the business, I believe, a very high rate.
Now, let me ask you about your relationship with Barbara, because
yes.
it was a marriage, essentially, for 40-some-odd years. How was that relationship?
Well, you know, it was the most amazing thing, because Barbara and I were great friends before we started the paper, and we liked each other very much, and we had a... She had a number of friends and people who were, in certain sense, she dealt with. I had a number of friends and other people and others who I dealt with. And there was a kind of natural division between us, but we didn't feel competitive. And we had a kind of complicity. In a certain sense, we hardly often had to talk at length because we would talk in a little shorthand of our own. And we would pass every manuscript back and forth between us. And so every writer, although they didn't know it often, had four eyes going over their work. And it was something that became a kind of series of understandings and intuitions that we were very happy in this collaboration.
It seems like a trusting dance.
It was. You see, another point about our life together, and this is something I miss very much, is that we had our own jokes about everything. We would sit and giggle and laugh about what we were doing quite often. And that was a great bond between us.
It sounds to me like, yes, it was a professional marriage. You trusted each other.
Yeah.
You laughed.
We had fun together.
It seems like a recipe for a marriage as well, for a
relationship. Well, Barbara had her own marital life, and so did I. So that was something else.
What do you think she would say bothered her about you, if anything?
Well, that's a good question. I think that sometimes you might say that I might have been about certain articles demanding too much.
Do you think you're over demanding?
No, but I think that this was something we both might have said about the other.
I want to go back to the relationship question, if you don't mind.
No.
Because, again, it does seem like there could have been a loving relationship beyond the professional. And I know she had her married life and you had yours, but was there ever any discussion of that?
No. Funnily enough, I think that we felt, both of us, that there was a particular excitement and honor, even, and vocation in this chance we had, this extraordinary opportunity, which two editors never have had before, probably, to do whatever the hell they wanted and still survive. That particular fascination with the possibilities of the paper was consuming.
In a way that you didn't need anything outside of that.
That's what I mean.
I want to talk about your personal style.
Yeah.
You had a 60th birthday where writers contributed to a book of sorts for Bob Silvers.
That's right. It was not my idea, I can assure you. But Elizabeth Hardwick and some other people got together and they did that.
One recurring theme throughout that book was, aside from the immense respect they hold for you, how meticulous you are and how demanding you are as an editor. They say that you worked all hours of the night. Tell me about your work life.
Well, it is true. I mean, I do envy editors who have a life arranged with deputies and associates and so on who take over a lot of the work. And they are like conductors of an orchestra. But I can't do that. And I pick up the manuscript, I can simply let my eye pass over things and say, oh, well, somebody else will look after this. I feel I must concentrate on it to try and make it the best possible thing. And also we have a whole bunch of, we had very strong views about actual prose. The whole group of words that which you don't find in the New York Review.
What are some of those words you won't find, or those
well,
phrases?
Well, for example, we are very suspicious of the phrase "in terms of." People use it all the time. But then you say, well, what are the terms? So we feel that we felt, Barbara and I, that the word context was being abused. Now the context is everything. It's the surroundings, it's the background, it's everyone is contextualizing, and so on.
Now, writers have said that you have found them at all hours of the day and in all countries of the world, just so you could ask them to please check punctuation in a sentence. For instance, I think it was Ronald Dworkin who said that his wife was complaining that Bob Silvers calls every Christmas to have this to have an editorial conversation. And Ronald said, oh, she exaggerates. He's called on Christmas only twice.
Well, the horror of it is that as we go to that, our schedule has always been terrible in the sense that we have a January issue that does go to press around Christmas, maybe not Christmas Day. But there's a real question here. We have a code, Barbara and I, and I believe in it. which is that no word or even punctuation mark will appear in the paper that the author hasn't approved. So in some of these instances, many editors and many magazines would simply change it. But I believe in that while on the one hand we're very demanding with the writers and ask them to rewrite things and we'd make many suggestions to them of our own, in our own writing, that the final text, they must approve every word and every comment must be theirs in the end.
And that means having to call them in Thailand.
And if there is a, and suddenly if you want to change the sentence and take out the semicolon and put in a period, it may not be what they want. And so you have to call up and say, is it okay?
What are some of the places, where are some of the places you have called at midnight?
Well, you know, you don't think about it in advance, but then someone says, well, I say, where can we get hold of Pankaj Mishra? We have this piece and there's a huge paragraph here. We must break it up. And someone says, well, you know, he was in London last week, but he's gone to Tibet. So there's nothing to do but call the Star Hotel in Tibet.
What has been the most rewarding part of editing the New York Review of Books?
You know what? If I feel I have a good issue, it comes out every 2 weeks. And so that they have, say, 20 articles, 40 books reviewed, and so on. So I look at it, and I think, well, there it is. There's a mixture of things. There are some articles I love in it, some articles I think could be better. But the most rewarding thing is when you pick up that issue. I've done it, it's out there, and it's going to take its place in the world. People are going to fight over it, whatever. But that's it. You've done it. It exists. You've done it.
Bob Silvers, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. Coming up, we'll meet Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo, the first company to make digital video recorders, or DVRs, which allow consumers to record TV programs, skip over ads, or watch the programs at their convenience. Jim started TiVo in 1997 with his partner, Michael Ramsey. Jim worked at Hewlett-Packard, Bell Labs, and Silicon Graphics prior to starting TiVo. Welcome.
Well, thanks. Thank you very much.
So, Jim, what role did TV play in your life growing up?
As a child, I was raised with the TV in the house. I even have some very dim memories of the transition from black and white to color television. I watched every episode of Star Trek many times and could repeat a lot of the dialogue. I was like a lot of men, I think, in terms of once you got the remote control, you just sit there and flip channels. And looking for something interesting to watch. I don't do that anymore.
I notice how you said a lot of men use the remote control. It's so true. Why don't you think more women use the remote control for surfing television as much as men do?
I don't know. Maybe we're just more easily bored by the stuff that's on television.
You got your bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and your master's degree in computer science. Did you have any idea then that you would be working on television projects, or what did you want to do with those degrees, did you think?
When I left college, it was really a focus on computers and computer networking, programming, things like that. It wasn't until I was working for Silicon Graphics in the early 90s that I started to get involved with television. And digital television.
You left Silicon Graphics in 1996. When you left, you started your own company called Network Age Software. What was the goal for this company?
Well, in working with especially the full service network and looking at all the interactive TV work that had gone on, I felt that there was an opportunity in the management and moving around of huge amounts of digital information. The movies, for instance, that were played back over the Time Warner, the video on demand system, were simply massive, many gigabytes of data. So I felt there's an opportunity to build software to manage how you move data around. I had developed that company for about a year. And at that time, Mike had just left Silicon Graphics. And so I called him up and said, let's do lunch. We had a nice lunch, but we started talking about how we both were very interested in starting up something from scratch. And as we started talking, we both came to the notion that there was going to be an opportunity in the home for people, that music was starting to be digital, most television content and movie content would be digital over time, and that we had an opportunity there to put together a company and a product that would help people in managing all this stuff in your home.
Incidentally, you had been a good soldier working at Hewlett-Packard and Bell Labs and Silicon Graphics, these very large companies, and here you are now venturing out on your own, first by yourself and then with Michael. How did you feel?
Well, as you point out, I'd been, coddled in the big corporate world for a while, and the thought of stepping out on my own and trying something was scary, frankly. But after a while, it was as if a weight had lifted off my shoulders, because working for SGI had actually been very stressful, and I didn't quite realize how stressful it was until I left. And at that point, I started feeling much better about the decision and stopped being afraid.
Do you remember some of the early days when, or some of those first mornings when you woke up and you didn't have to get in the car and go to work?
Yeah, I do. One part of it was disciplining myself to be able to, you go and you eat breakfast and do whatever and then sit down and work. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really sat down and worked at home before.
How did your wife feel about it?
Well, frankly, at the time, she said, you need to do whatever is right for you. Just make sure we don't lose the house. And so I made sure we didn't lose the house.
You and Michael decide to start this company together, but the project that you were working on initially was far from the TiVo product that you ultimately developed. You started to create a home network system where you would have a sensor in the refrigerator telling the consumer when their milk was sour. Could you give other examples of the practical implications of what the technology that this home network system could do?
We had the notion that you'd be able to plug your camera in and download pictures off of your camera, that you would have one of these small satellite set-tops that connected to your home stereo system and allow you to play back your music. It might hook to your phone system and be a sort of a personal voicemail. I have a slide that I did at that time where I put all these things on one slide, and we called it the Grand Vision slide. I think I had a coffee maker on there that might be controlled. It was a field of dreams. But as we dove in to fleshing it out and starting to line up the technologies we'd need to actually make this stuff work, it became clear that the networking technology available at that time wasn't going to be sufficient to handle the kinds of kept data that we were thinking about moving around. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but Mike and I were sitting around and talking one day, and it might have been with some other people too, and somebody said, well, wouldn't it be great if you could pause live television? And I thought, well, that's sort of an interesting notion. I wonder if we could do that. And as I sat there for a minute, I went, I understand enough about computers and digital content and everything. I could do that. I could figure out how to do that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. Jim founded TiVo in 1997 with his partner Michael Ramsey, and the company was first profitable in 2005. So finally, you had this aha moment where you said, okay, let's focus our technology on building this device for television. Talk to me about how venture capitalists received this idea.
The initial idea was this home server on a home network distributing media throughout your home. And it was interesting. The two venture firms that we worked with, NEA and IVP, both had partners at those firms that knew Mike and I from previous experiences at Silicon Graphics. I remember one of the partners, his name was Jeff Yang. He says, you know, this is a crazy idea. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I'll bet you guys are going to come up with something. So they didn't really fund us based on the idea. They funded us based on it being Mike and I.
So you were well received by the venture capital community. But did you expect the degree of controversy that would come from elsewhere, you know, from the TV, the cable companies?
You mean in terms of skipping ads?
Exactly.
yes and no. I didn't particularly like watching commercials, and I was more than happy to build a device that could allow you to skip over them. At the same time, we knew that the networks, especially who derived all their revenue from advertising, would be very nervous about this technology. So we went to them very early on at TiVo, and we said, look at what we're building. Said, you know, this thing is coming, but in years down the road, it's going to be very common. And what you should do is get on board now. In fact, we think you should invest in TiVo and make sure that instead of running away from this thing, that you're part of it. You know, if you're going to take away the 30-second spot, then we felt we needed to give back other ways of advertising, other ways of reaching the consumer within TiVo. And so we developed quite a large number of different kinds of interactive advertising technologies that are still with us today.
So what was their response?
Well, it depends. Advertisers were actually quite excited about the potential and the possibilities that we were showing them, new ways to advertise to get beyond the 30-second spot. The networks were sort of split. There were some that were very far-sighted, and there were other entities that were very afraid.
And didn't one network executive ask Michael if he was the devil?
he probably did.
Were you in that meeting?
No, I wasn't. Mm. Michael tended to be the guy out talking a lot to everybody, where I like to be, you know, back in the lab working on actually making things work.
You talk about other potential revenue models for the networks if you were going to be threatening these 30-second ads, and that raises an issue of privacy concerns. You know, you'd have to inherently be giving or releasing data about your viewers because you have this information, and that caused some viewers to, you know, feel uncomfortable.
Well, we were very concerned about maintaining people's privacy, but still being able to build a business. You know, the engineers at TiVo, especially in those days, in the early days, we were all a bunch of libertarian software engineers, and we didn't want anybody invading our privacy either. So we were very careful about how we constructed the systems for collecting data in such a way that we could guarantee people's privacy and still be able to aggregate the kind of information that networks and advertisers would really want to have. In fact, early on, we had a customer who hooked up to the phone line going in and out of the TiVo and saw the data going back and forth and called up his congressman who asked the FTC to investigate us, which was fine because we were able to demonstrate to the FTC, to their total satisfaction, that we couldn't go and back and correlate the data that came back to us with an individual.
While you had a relatively easy time raising capital, whether it was from the venture capitalists or from some of the media companies like NBC or AOL, which invested $200 million, you faced a lot of hurdles elsewhere, for instance, in just by consumers. You know, consumer adoption wasn't as quick, perhaps, as you thought it would be. Were you surprised by the lackluster response of consumers in the early days? I know people were very excited about this new technology, but it really took a while for consumer adoption to ramp up.
Yes, it did. And I think we were surprised about that because, having built prototypes and everybody in the company took them home and lived with these things, we all understood how life-changing the technology was. I think the problem that we face that we didn't quite understand at first was that for most people, they didn't think of television as being broken. So coming in with a new concept that says, well, now you actually can totally control your viewing, most people didn't quite compute that at first because there wasn't a space in it in their head that neatly fit into. And so in the early days, a lot of our efforts were around education of the market.
One of the challenges to consumer adoption might have been the price. TiVo was $499 plus a $9.95 a month fee on top of that. And you took efforts to subsidize that price. What are some other examples of some hurdles that you faced early on, aside from the consumer adoption issue?
The early days of TiVo were sort of a heady time. You know, we were there in that phase of the expansion of the internet bubble. We went public in September of 1999. The stock was priced at $16 and hit $78 on that same day. Of course, not long after that, we had the bursting, if you will, of the internet bubble, and funding dried up. I remember when we had to make the very difficult decision in 2001 to lay off people in the company. And having to do a layoff was a huge emotional downer because we had so built the company on taking care of people, but we really had no choice if we wanted to stay in business. And then what happened was Philips and Sony and some of the other partners you're working with decided that they didn't want to work with us anymore because we wouldn't pay them a subsidy anymore on their products. And so we got to a point where we were down to our last tens of millions of dollars in the bank and had no distribution. And we sat around and looked at each other and said, we're not quitting. If we have to, we'll throw these things on the back of a truck and we'll drive them around and sell them on the back of the truck. We never quite had to do that because by that time, Best Buy had become very interested in TiVo, the brand, and we signed a deal with them where they distributed TiVo boxes, and that allowed us to skate through that time of thin amounts of money and come out the other side in a way as strong or stronger than we'd ever been.
Just on an existential level, since you really were the pioneer behind the DVR or the digital video recorder, how do you feel about being on the founding team that developed this technology, which, you know, is becoming more pervasive, even if it's not in the form of a TiVo machine?
Well, I've found it incredibly gratifying. It still happens today, but in the early days, I'd be talking to somebody and say, oh, yeah, I'm with TiVo. And it was like, TiVo, you're with TiVo. That's the greatest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. I've had people come up and say, you know, my 3-year-old can use the TiVo. It's so easy to use. My grandmother uses it with no trouble at all. It's interesting to me that a lot of the technology that we developed, we've been able to license to a lot of different people. It's used in quite a few different DVRs that aren't under the TiVo brand. So from a pure technology, intellectual property point of view, it's also gratifying to have developed something that has become so pervasive for people in their lives.
Even the word TiVo has become generic and is used as a verb, you know, oh, I TiVo this show, I TiVo that show, you know, kind of like Kleenex or Band-Aids. How did you feel about that term becoming generic?
You know, it's a two-faced thing. It's really gratifying to have created a verb, created a whole concept for people that they want to talk about it that way. On the other hand, the control of TiVo, there's a particular whole set of legal steps that we need to take to protect our trademark, to protect that verb. And so we have to take actual action to tell people when they use TiVo as a generic verb that, no, you can't do that.
How did you come up with the name originally?
Teleworld was the name we came up with originally when we first got funded by the venture capitalists. It was really a placeholder name until we went through a whole exercise, a naming exercise, and started off with 800 names on a wall. What we did at the company is we actually took all the different names that had been thought of and posted them on the walls, and then everybody got a sticker that they could go and stick on whichever piece of paper had the name that they liked. But there was a formal acknowledgement that there was Texas and California, which is me and Mike, and that we got the big vote in the end.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. I was pleased and flattered that you asked me to join.
My guest has been Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.